Attention all you rule breakers, you misfits and troublemakers, all you free spirits and pioneers, all you visionaries and nonconformists. Everything the establishment has told you is wrong with you is actually what's right with you. You see things others don't. You are hardwired to change the world.
You are listening to the Spiritual Activist Radio Show, and I am Rahasia Uncensored, where we look at the world not as it is, but as we know it can be, if and only if we have the courage to question the answers we've been given. This is our world, and it's time for us to take it back.
Okay, Foster, I appreciate you taking your time to do this interview.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you. I appreciate your taking the time as well and giving me an opportunity to speak with your community.
Well, this is an important subject that we're on, because I think we talked briefly about the importance of technology, which actually brings up an important point for me, because I'm not too sure that we have enough left of the old system that it will correct itself, which tells me that a conscious and deliberate dismantling of some of the old paradigms might be more important than we think while we still have some infrastructure left, like the internet, for instance. Because it seems to me if we drive this thing to the ultimate end, we're either going to live in a police state or we're going to completely wipe out civilization as we know it, and then building back from a grassroots point is going to be really tough. So it seems like it would be better to really take control of this situation. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with you that we're really at a critical fork in the road, as I mentioned in the movie Thrive, that if we keep going the direction we're going, it's only going to get more constricted as the powers that be assume more control over people's lives. And with current technologies, there's the capability of controlling people in a way that, you know, tyrants of the past have always dreamt of, but never been able to actually accomplish. I must say right now, I'm actually more optimistic than I've been in the last 10 years, any time, with the kind of emergence of consciousness and responsibility and information, the type of information that you bring out, the type of information that we're trying to bring out, so that people can actually begin to get an accurate assessment of their reality. You know, I was a martial artist for many years. I trained and taught in the martial art of Aikido for 15 years, and I also did karate and tai chi. And I know from the martial arts experience that the number one imperative of protecting yourself and your loved ones is an accurate assessment of your reality. So it's uncomfortable for a lot of people, as it was for me, continues to be for me, to be facing a lot of the domination agendas that we're facing and the truly destructive intent. You know, you and I don't wake up in the morning thinking, how can we control everybody else's life? But unless we realize that there are people who do that, we won't have responses that are really commensurate to the predicament that we're in. So with a combination of the I would say, a spiritual and activist emergence that I see going on all over the world, and the fact that we still have the internet open to communicate with each other, the information and best practices, and to brainstorm strategies together on a global scale. And then with the type of courage that I'm seeing with so many people in the Occupy movement and other activist movements all over the world, we're really in the first global revolution in history. And, you know, the jury's still out as to how successful it will be. And the conversations are going on all over the world as to what are the guiding principles? What are we actually looking to replace a current destructive system with? But I'm very excited about the way those conversations are starting to go, and just about the emergence of that incredible power and beauty of the human spirit that I'm seeing everywhere. And if that continues, and I think we can continue that, then I actually think within the next decade or two, we can tip this thing. We can actually go through the tipping point to where we're turning to take that other road, where we're actually rigorously starting to create relationships, institutions, and so forth that are based on integrity and individual rights, on true justice, rather than on just on power and accumulation of money and on fear and domination. So I'm actually feeling quite good about it at the time. And I know that you've done a lot of work, which I admire, on really being willing to stand back and look at our belief systems. And I think there's nothing more critical that we can do, because unless you realize that you are operating from a worldview, as is everyone else, you will just unconsciously come up with the results of that worldview. And certainly, I would say the most humbling part of my path over the last 40 years of research is to come to the realization again and again and again that virtually everything I thought I knew about the world we're living in turned out to be not true.
Right.
And building the skill to humbly recognize, oh, I thought this, but it turns out that, is, I think, one of the key skills. And I appreciate your work in encouraging people to learn to get good at that, and to realize that your world doesn't fall apart when your old worldview is replaced by a new one.
Yeah, my wife and I, we had dinner with David Icke three or four months ago, and we started talking about how belief systems, by their very nature, divide us. And due to the cognitive processing of our minds, we see the world not as it is, but as we are. And when I started dismantling beliefs that were indoctrinated into me since I was a little child,
yeah,
it was, at first it was a little bit scary, because I felt my aloneness, my separateness with no support system. But something really sort of amazing happens when you really break down those filters. You start seeing the world more closely as it is. But even now, talking to you, I feel something in my chest area when we're talking about certain thoughts that I couldn't feel before, because it wasn't part of my belief system. And this is part of my experience, which is a total different thing. And I think as we go on, we're going to have to look at these things, because I know when I wrote my book, it was, where did these belief systems come from? And it sounds like you went through the same thing. When you start tracing everything back, it leads into, at some point, these beings came down from the sky all over the planet and sort of helped us in our previous civilization. So I think, and this is a big one for people to handle, and I really admire you for bringing this up, because when I wrote my book on the social and neurological consequences of belief systems, I really hesitated putting the ET information in there, because I felt like it would invalidate the hard science behind what I was saying. But it's time that we start acknowledging this, at least the strong possibility that we have been influenced, we are being influenced, and we're probably being prepared. I mean, from the crop circles and everything, it seems like they want to make contact as soon as we can get ready.
Well, we have a quote in our film that says, when an honest man discovers he's mistaken, he either ceases to be honest, he either ceases to be mistaken, or he ceases to be honest.
Right.
And we're all being called to go through many moments of exactly that, of asking ourselves, is it more important for me in this moment to hold on to my past beliefs, to look good, to try to convince somebody that I'm right, or to actually know the truth? And I think that it's the evolutionary imperative for humanity right now to actually wake up and realize, as I also say in the movie, that we're not a mistake. We're simply mistaken. We have been intentionally duped by the powers that be for a long, long time. I mean, the central banking system, the whole fractional reserve system alone, has essentially been kept secret from most of us for 400 years. That's humbling. But now we've got the media where people can, like you and I, can be in conversation with each other very easily, without having to own a TV station. And so people are starting to get the information that may be uncomfortable, but as my wife says in the movie, it's like finding out that you've got a dangerous but treatable disease. You can either ignore the knowledge, or if you accept the fact, then you can go and look to see, well, what might be able to cure it. And that's really the choice point for every one of us right now.
Yeah, I like what you said about the alternative energy when you were showing the picture. You said, I don't expect this to convince you, you know, and that's really important that people have their own experience, you know, to weigh all the facts. But what was it about that that really convinced you, just the actually seeing it?
So for 40 years, I've been studying physics and cosmology and spatial geometry, and it led me into this realization of this fundamental patterning. And as I began to work with some of the scientists who were also aware of the basic nature of this toroidal flow, this torus vortex, they began introducing me to some of their friends who were inventors, who were accessing energy in very unusual ways, not in according to any laws that I had been taught in my traditional physics training. And as I went around to these laboratories, sometimes I had physicists with me, sometimes engineers, sometimes on my own. My wife visited a couple of labs with me, and again, we would see these devices working. We could check and see that there weren't wires or batteries or microwaves. When I remember standing in one lab with my wife when we saw this, several devices actually working, and we looked at each other, and just tears came to our eyes with the, like what you were talking about, it's the kinesthetic realization of, oh my gosh, yep, it's here. And then for my left brain, it's clear to me, because of all the labs I visited and of all of the inventors I've studied, virtually every single one of them has been raided and shut down. Would they bother to do that with a bunch of hoaxer nutcases, you know, pretending to do stuff in their garage that wasn't actually working? I don't see the logic in that.
Yep.
So I know that there are over 5,000 patent applications which have been confiscated for alternative energy devices, and then the people gag ordered. You know, once again, it's under the guise of national security, but how is our national security served by sending our young people off to some foreign country to kill innocent people to try to take their resources, with which we'll then end up polluting the sky, when we actually have this, these various zero-point radian, so-called free energy devices working, and the government knows it. And that's the kind of experience that started me into, okay, if the story doesn't make sense, follow the money. So I started following the money, and it started to make sense why some people wouldn't want us all to have those technologies.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I think an advanced civilization would look at us and the fact that we're still drawing elements out of the ground and blowing them up and controlling the explosions is probably such a primal, backward thing to them. They probably have a hard time wrapping their heads around that, but except for the fact that they know that they've also been through this too.
Yes.
Which brings me to a point, you know, if I was a flower, nature, it seems like nature has been on this evolution of consciousness for billions of years, and there's actually a process behind that that doesn't require presence, self-awareness, or thought. When a flower gets up of a morning, it doesn't have to think, oh, here comes the sun, I need to, you know, it intuitively knows how to do it. Nature has brought itself to this point through automatic processes. But now there's a game changer. And the game changer is when we become participants. So what was once the evolution of consciousness has now become a conscious evolution, because we are participating in the process, which is the good news, but it's also the bad news if we're not careful, because we're at this critical point where both systems are existing, and we're trying to work our way up to this new system. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I agree with you totally that we're at the turning point in history where the evolution that has given us this body that we woke up into and beats our heart and breathes our lungs and heals our wounds and all that stuff that we'd be in trouble if our rational mind needed to handle. That evolution has gotten us here, but it's clear to me that our evolution, at least for humanity on this planet, it is seriously threatened if we don't become very skilled at learning to consciously participate in our own evolution. I think it's truly the next step in evolution is we with our consciousness need to learn to align our being, our bodies, our emotions, our minds, our communication with other people, and all of our systems and how we relate to our environment. We need to learn to align those with the forces of nature, and I would offer with the dynamics of the Torah, since that's how every sustainable system is built, or else our experiment, as Bucky Fuller warned, will fail on this planet, and it'll be set back, you know, several hundred million years, or just go to another planet, this whole experiment of consciousness that we're in the middle of on this planet at this time.
Yeah, you know, my wife and I, we've done the Flower of Life workshops with Drun Balo, and so we've studied a lot of sacred geometry, and we've done the Merkaba meditation, which is a tetrahedron, and it does seem to trigger some awareness when you do these sort of mental meditations.
Yeah.
But one thing that we learned in these sacred geometry classes is that everything starts from a sphere and starts opening up like into the flower of life. And I just wonder how many people grasp that. When I was watching your documentary, the graphics are so helpful because it allows your mind to grapple with these complexities of interdimensional shapes and forms. Because when you say a torus, we're tempted to think a three-dimensional figure, but it's actually the shadow of a fourth-dimensional field of energy. And I think we're getting there where we're starting to be able to see that, like a hypercube or a tesseract. You know, we can see the shadow of that form, and we have to remember that there's something very complex about this. And I think the graphics in your documentary makes it so much easier for a beginner to really look at this and have a little bit of an aha of the reality of that field.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that comes across. We've been getting positive feedback on that from people all over the world. And one of our goals, and the reason we spent the time and the money to create those effects, is to help people think in 3D, at least to come out of Flatland and realize that we're living in a world of geometry, that we're living in a sea of patterns, and that there are certain patterns which are fundamental, and once we can kind of embody that, it naturally opens up to the realization that we are experiencing such a small fraction of the spectrum of vibration. I mean, we know it from science that if you look at the spectrum of vibration, the light that we actually see and the vibration that we can feel and what we smell and so forth is a tiny band, and then we know that the vibrational scale goes way up faster and way down slower than we can actually experience ourselves. And I think our knowledge is very limited in terms of, you know, what a four, five, or six dimensional geometry might be like. But I think it's obvious to anyone who's seen that a dog can hear things that they can't, that there are vibrational planes that other beings would naturally be living on that we couldn't necessarily experience. And I know that Jacques Vallée, one of the key UFO researchers, has suggested that the vast majority of ET contact that is going on is actually going on interdimensionally. It's going on vibrationally through telepathic experience. And it's one of the reasons why I think that so many UFO witnesses experience some sort of ship being there and then blinking out, and then either coming back in or comes back in, you know, hundreds of miles away. And it isn't that it disappears ultimately, but it simply goes out of our perceptual range and probably alters. It moves into a different realm of space-time than the ones that we're taught about in school, and then reappears back into ours. So for me, the whole notion of experiencing ourselves as multidimensional beings is critical in opening up to what's possible for humanity if we're going to learn to come into harmony with each other on this planet and with beings from off this planet and really learn to thrive.
Yeah, as you're sitting there talking and I'm watching you, what was going through my mind was like using Skype right now to do this interview. It's like a prosthetic for my mind, but we're actually communicating on an interdimensional level, and I can sort of visualize our fields connecting because we're not really separated by space. We're in a non-spatial universe in this mysterious kind of a way that we've yet to be able to comprehend and figure out. And I think it's important as we go along to really realize that we're on the cusp of understanding new dimensions, new visualizations, and as we do this, we're going to have to change a lot of our past perceptions and be careful not to use those as a guideline. That's the reason I liked your compass idea of using the Taurus as a compass, because the new north isn't exactly just that way. It's like this interdimensional thing that we have to aim for.
Yeah. Well, the whole notion that you're talking about our belief systems, I do a whole section on the website. One of our 13 primary sectors of human endeavor that we identify and always use as a navigation system for whole system thinking is worldview itself. And one of the things that I did over the years of my research was talk to or read the works of people like Ken Wilber and Ashok Gangadin and Arthur Young and Walter Russell and Dwayne Elch and people like that. And I was kind of startled and delighted to see that those people who've been studying the history of the evolution of consciousness have all come to some sort of realization of an octave process in evolution. And they virtually all identify that we're in the what they would call the fourth stage of that octave. And we can compare that where we are in the human octave to where humans are in the larger octave that actually runs from pure potential through subatomic particles to atoms to molecules, and then takes this turn of beginning to evolve into consciousness of the plants, animals, and then humans. And where we are in the human octave is where the molecule is in the larger octave. What can we learn from that? Well, what happens in the fourth stage, what the molecule did, was it learned to balance energy. It learned to balance the external energy with the internal energy, and that allowed it to master sustaining temperature. And all of life as we know it, including our plants that we eat and the animals that we relate to and and ourselves, all of that is based on what, thank goodness, the molecule mastered. And in the human octave, now we're trying to move from the fourth stage into the fifth stage, what Dwayne Elgin calls reconciliation. And in order to do that, we need to learn to balance external energy with internal energy. So we need to learn to relax our body, allow our emotions to flow freely and responsibly, to allow our minds to be open and at the same time have the ability to focus, and then to learn to communicate effectively without conflict with other people, and then to learn to relate sustainably to the environment. And if we do that, then we'll actually be a thriving species on planet Earth. We will have learned this next step in conscious evolution, and then the next three stages of human evolution in an incarnate form will be built on top of that. And it's almost impossible even to imagine what that would be, but the two qualities that I know would be there beyond what we can even picture is love and creativity. Because that, in my experience, is what always gets unleashed, always becomes available as people align their selves and their relationships with natural principles. And that's pretty exciting exciting future to imagine. I think this is definitely a planet worth saving.
Definitely. I think it's a humanity worth saving too. So, Foster, I'm just curious, on a personal level, it seems like you were born into a life of privilege, and you had the possibility of taking your life in a total different way. Did you have an aha moment, or was it just a gradual realization that you had to do something different with your life?
Well, as I mentioned in the film, when I was very young and tucked under my desk with a siren going off in a nuclear explosion drill, that was the first moment I remember when I thought, you know, the people in charge may not know what they're doing here.
Right.
Because this is, my desk is not going to protect me from this. And so that loomed in my mind for a long time. And I think that's one of the reasons perhaps why I was drawn to the realization, to this vision that I had later on when I was 14 of the toroidal form. And I was shown kind of a full-blown vision that I then spent decades trying to understand and ultimately to apply, which is a lot of the basis of the solutions in Thrive. But then when I was graduating from college and starting to go out into the world, I had been a filmmaker in college and was expected to go on and to Hollywood and make feature films and so forth. And I realized that I didn't have anything to say that was worth all that time and money and technology. And so instead, as I looked around, I saw that we were still under increasing risk of nuclear holocaust. We were destroying our very environment. We were invading Cambodia for no reason that I could well understand. And so I had a very intense moment where I thought when I learned that I was going to inherit just enough money that if I managed it carefully, I would be able to choose what I wanted to do with my life rather than complain about my job. I had to really sit down with myself and friends and go, okay, what is my life about? And I've always been fascinated by media, and I knew even at that time, I could feel through logic and intuition that before too long, there would be a global information delivery system. I thought it would be just satellites and TVs and so forth. I had not anticipated the internet. But all of that is now here. You and I can be talking to each other. We could be doing this if you're on the other side of the planet rather than just 100 miles away. So I decided to devote my life to finding out what was in the way of our thriving. And if I found that out and found out a way through that predicament for humanity, then that's what I would make a movie about. I thought it would take 5 or 10 years. Well, 41 years later, here we are. But this is finally the movie that is Thrive and is a tremendous fulfillment for me to be able to share with people all over the world through the technology that's available now and hopefully save them the time that I needed to spend to be able to follow the questions that most people don't have the time to. And hopefully I found enough strong evidence of what's really going on and enough viable and accessible solutions that it can be of value to people as we're trying to figure out how to stand up for our lives, really.
Yeah, because a lot of the information that you're supplying in the documentary, it's done in such a way, I know some of that information is so esoteric that it's very difficult for the guy that's raising a family, has four kids, and trying to get them to school, fix the car. It's really difficult for the average person to get some of this esoteric information and comprehend it. So it's really important if people can grab that information and bring it down to a level to where it's comprehensible, because then people can take it in and start understanding it. I ran into this a little bit one issue back. I did a whole issue on chemtrails, and I was amazed at the people in the community that don't know about chemtrails. And I say, well, look up. Like, all you have to do is look up. They say, oh, those are condensation trails. And I say, well, what do you think? They cancel all the international and national flights some days? Because some days they're there, some days they're not. And just a little bit of logic and reasoning sort of brings them up a little bit. But we are so bombarded by information that to really put information out there clearly, and decisively, and fact-checked like you did is so important, because we get so much propaganda that people are just right off the top questioning and going, nah, this probably isn't true. So backing it up with facts has been a crucial part of my journalistic endeavor also. So,
but it's critical, and my wife and I expected that there would be a lot of controversy about the information in our film as we came out. There's been hardly any at all from all over the world. And I think it's a lot because of what you just said, that we took many years to talk to the experts, to fact check, to cross-reference, put the facts on the internet, and then not put it out until we had put the pieces together into a story that makes a heck of a lot more sense than what we're being told by the corporate media. So I was very concerned as to whether or not people would be able to take in the information that took me decades to gather and sometimes, you know, weeks and months to process individual issues emotionally. When I found out about chemtrails, and I see them almost daily over my head, I've got hundreds of photographs of, you know, 7, 8, 12 crisscrossing lines spreading out, eventually taking over the whole sky right over my head. When I found out about that, and that I am not able to actually stop them even today, it can be devastating, and it was really hard for me. So I was nervous about putting out so much information in just 2 hours, but we haven't been running across that problem virtually at all. Yet people say, yes, there are intense parts of the film, but thank you for tying the pieces together into one coherent story. And the fact that it was, that it begins with, people can see that we absolutely love humanity and the planet that we live on and the wonders of nature. And it's from our love of that we're wanting to communicate the dangers of what's in the way. And the fact that we wrap the information in that beauty and then cohere it with really accessible, viable solutions that people can do in their individual lives that don't take a lot of time and money. Mostly what we've been getting is just really heartfelt thanks for wrapping that much together in a coherent and grounded way so that people feel like they can finally get traction. So many people have been so confused and so scared and so in debt that it's just been paralyzing. And now people are going like, okay, at least now I know who's screwing me, how and why, and some things that I can do about it. So there's this tremendous energy that's being unleashed through the movie and the website, and the Occupy movement is starting to use the film and the website to aid in their discussions. So through their networks, a lot of people are simply accelerating the conversation about, okay, what's the world that we can actually build to replace this one that's built on scarcity and fear and deception and domination? So I'm actually really thrilled with how people are taking this in and passing it on to their friends and neighbors and coworkers.
Yeah, it was a nice surprise for me. I was interviewed on Coast to Coast, and George was preparing the listeners and saying that this is going to be really conflictive and, you know, don't get offended. But, you know, we didn't have any complaints.
Right.
And out of the hundreds of emails that I received, none of them were complaints. And it just made me aware of the fact that people are more open to this.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've only had one person stand up in one of my lectures, and she stood up in the middle of it and said, is this going to end happy? And
right.
You know, and I said, well, you know, I don't really know. I mean, that's a linear kind of a question, you know, but the audience put the person in check, you know,
as if we aren't each involved in how this is going to proceed.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm really glad to hear that you also have been getting that kind of reception, because people have been thanking us for respecting their intelligence and not holding back. People,
right.
You know, we're all human beings who are born to thrive. Each one of us was the winner in the swimming race amongst 600 million other sperm. So every single person on this planet came here through a lot of intention.
Right.
And it is our birthright to be pulled toward thriving. Now, that's not given to us. We need to figure out how to do that, and sometimes it takes a lot of work, and there's a lot of people working hard on it. But as we move toward that, then we can expose what's in the way and have really honest conversations about it. And one of the things I love about your work is that you're willing to inspect belief systems. And in our section in the website on worldview, I say very clearly that I honor and respect everybody's belief system as long as their behavior doesn't violate other people. And the two greatest violations, the greatest sources of violence, destruction, and death in the history of humanity have been religion and the state. And the state is number one. And those are the two things that are most uncomfortable, it seems like, for people to be willing to really talk about with each other, because we've been so indoctrinated into various belief systems for which there's not a lot of evidence. And a philosopher that I respect a lot, Stéphane Molyneux of Free Domain Radio, points out that in order to get people to believe stories which they wouldn't naturally come up with in their direct experience or defies their everyday experience, you have to capture people at a very young age, indoctrinate them on a regular basis with a lot of threats of fear and violence if they don't believe, and sustain that over years. Well, that's exactly what the church and the state do, you know, through making kids go to particular churches and believe particular things, whether it makes sense to them or not, and making them go to schools where they get indoctrinated into the absolute necessity for the authoritarian state with a monopoly on money and force. We wouldn't believe in those things naturally unless we were trained over many years and intimidated into going along with that system. So once again, if somebody wants to believe in the benevolence of the state or in the efficacy of a particular religion, that's fine with me. Just don't impose it on me or anyone else, because that's when the violence starts. And particularly with the technology that we've got on this planet, we can't afford to have states or religions warring with each other right now, or it could be the end of life as we know it on this planet.
Yeah, one of the aspects of that, even 200 years ago, if you wanted to dominate or wipe out a culture of a million people, you pretty much had to get a million people together with arms and food and transportation. It was a big motivational thing you had to do. Now it takes one person with a suitcase bomb in a motel in New York City. So that's a game changer.
Yes, and one politician can send us into wars where millions of people get killed, whether we support that or not. And if people actually had to donate to go to war, you know, how many wars would there actually be? It's been the creation of this notion of the state that always depends on involuntary taxation, that allows a very few people to amass these giant armies and go attack other individual human beings as if they were like the other team on a football field or somehow part of that state rather than actual sovereign human beings. So that it's a major, major misunderstanding that that I don't blame humanity for. Once again, I don't see us as a mistake. We're mistaken. We've been duped into those belief systems. But now is the time, and particularly with the internet type of communications that we can have on a mass scale, for us to have really grounded conversations about what do we experience to be true, what have we been indoctrinated to be true, and then to experiment with new ways of relating based on the only thing that I found that everybody agrees to is they don't want to be violated, and they don't think other people should be violated against their will, unless they want to do it for some particular reason. But if that's the core ethic for humanity, then we need to be in the conversation of what would our institutions look like? What would our economies look like if nobody ever gets authorized to violate somebody else against their will unless it's in true self-defense?
Right. So what are some of the things we could do, Foster, realistically? Somebody listening to this, what can they do today and tomorrow and the next day to go out and start adding their little bit of effort to reverse this process?
Well, the first thing that I would recommend is just get as informed as you can until you reach a tipping point within yourself where you have a sense of, oh, okay, now I get more what's going on and I want to do something about it. And then Be willing to speak up to your friends. Step out of what David Icke calls the hassle-free zone, and be willing to speak the truth to your friends and family and loved ones and coworkers. And then start to link up electronically if you're not already, so that you can communicate with a lot of people at the same time, so that you can learn from them and share the truths that you find. And what's beginning to arise is a network of networks worldwide of people sharing solid truth toward peace and justice and environmental sustainability. And as Paul Hawken points out, it's the greatest social movement in history. It's non-centralized. It's not, you know, personality-based. So it truly is unstoppable. And then other things that you can do in your daily life is, first of all, you can take your money out of the what Catherine Austin Fitz calls the tapeworm banks, who are really, it's becoming more clear, robbing everybody, and then using that money to not only provide themselves, you know, bonuses and buy more houses and yachts and so forth, but to create more nuclear power plants or coal-fired power plants or more clear cutting and so forth. They fund the major corporations that do those projects. So every time you take $1,000 out of a bank like that, you're taking $10,000 of lending power out of that bank and putting it into your local bank or credit union. And then that money stays in your community and funds local projects and housing and businesses and so forth that can actually grow your community, rather than sucking the capital out of your community, where it's in New York and London overnight funding destructive projects. And as well, realize that you vote every time that you buy or invest. Check out, you know, what is the company? How do they treat their employees? Where are they getting their resources? So that you're voting with how you spend, because everybody does that virtually on a daily basis. And then I would say the single most important thing that we can do for the emerging revolution after getting rid of the central banking and fractional reserve scam is a fight to keep the internet open, so that we can do just what we're doing in this conversation right now. Because it's no longer open in China and North Korea and many other countries across the world. And the U.S. government is trying to take it over, and major corporations are trying to take it over, and the U.N. is trying to take it over. So join some sort of coalition. They're easy to find on the internet that is fighting to keep the internet fair and open. And in terms of our food, don't tolerate GMO foods. Don't tolerate GMO growing in your area. There are thousands of GMO-free zones now all across Europe, but there's hardly any the United States, and the powers that be are trying to get people to consume these GMO foods and be not only controlled in our farming and agriculture, but there are very toxic substances in these GMO foods which have been proven to cause cancer and infertility in animal studies in the second and third generation. This is the maybe second only to the chemtrail issue in terms of universal toxicity. I'm really glad you brought up that chemtrail issue, because in our environment section on our website, in our critical issues section, I think we identify seven different critical issues. And after the nuclear toxicity, the number two issue for me is chemtrails. Yep. We are being poisoned from the skies on almost a daily basis in virtually every major country now in the world, and hardly anybody knows it. It's the grossest violation of human beings that I frankly ever heard of. And so anything that you can do to get informed on that and start waking people up, there's a great film, a recent one called What on Earth Are They Spraying? You can go to carnicom.com. Clifford Carnicom has been investigating this for years, and the issue that you did is fantastic. This is an issue, I could go on and on about these things, but these are some of the core issues. Just connect with your friends, get active, because there's not any time to waste on it.
What would you say about the that's the outer work? What would you say about the inner work? How important do you think meditation is, and finding those quiet places inside yourself, whether it's through a keto or meditation or whatever?
Well, I think that the inner work is equally critical, and it's vital to realize that neither one replaces the other. That for each one of us, our challenge is to remain whole. And that means to nurture our inner wholeness while working to create outer wholeness as well. And I think that there are an infinite number of valuable practices. I know for me, I have spent a lot of time with meditation, with yoga, with self-hypnosis, with Aikido, with music, with walking in nature. There are many ways to do it. One of my most important teachers was this amazing mystic, and I asked her one time, how in the world did you attain this state of consciousness from which she was capable of doing just remarkable things? And she said, well, I always had kids, a pack of young kids, so I didn't have much time. But as soon as the kids would go to sleep, I would start doing 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzles. And it was that focus and that concentration that opened me up to other realms that then I welcomed in. So I strongly encourage people to do whatever they can. And there's an article, I did an article on this on the website. If you go to the solutions section to what can I do, there's a support section, how to take care of yourself while being active in the world. And I break it down to what I found in my path is you need to have some way of learning to integrate your body, the physicalness. Then also find teachings that help you learn to balance your emotions, to allow a flow through and to be emotional as you need to be, but not in ways that take it out on other people. Or, don't lose control of your emotions while you're driving on the freeway, but learn to open up to and honor your emotional flow. And then in your mind, I ran a company in Silicon Valley for 8 years called Mind Center, where we really studied and helped people through brainwave biofeedback and meditation and other things to learn to both open their minds and to focus their minds. And then if you get good at those three levels, then the spiritual level, in a sense, will take care of itself. Because in my experience, we are all, in our essence, spiritual beings. We don't have to go find that spirituality somewhere else. It's usually more a matter of clearing away the blocks, how we're holding in our body or resisting the emotion or confused or obsessed in our minds. As we learn to clear those things out, your spiritual being will just radiate from you. And then that's where it starts to meet the outer world of learning to get good at conflict resolution and choose what you want to be active with in the world. And when, as you're involved in all of those, it's not like a whole lot of different disciplines. It begins to be, oh, I'm actually learning to live in harmony with every aspect of my life. And the experience of love then can blossom. And I think that's what thriving is all about.
Yeah, and it seems like our mind learns really quickly when it has the correct feedback. You mentioning what you were doing in San Francisco, you say?
This was in Silicon Valley.
Silicon Valley. Yeah, my wife and I, we did some neural feedback training in Mountain View at BioCybernaut. And through a week training, just doing strict neural feedback, getting into alpha state, I realized how quickly my mind learns to feel good and to learn that alpha state. And to this day, I know what that alpha state feels like now, so I can get there more easily. And I think we do the same thing with compassion and empathy. The more familiar we can get with this and the more positive feedback that we get from it, I think the easier it's going to be on people to open up a whole new vision of what their world, what their life can be like. And that's what this came across, by the way, with you and your wife. My wife and I really appreciated your wife's emotional, how that comes across in film, I don't know, but emotions come across, and hers was so truthful and so honest and so exposed that it really added an element to the documentary that we really appreciated. I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that. One of the things that I'm most thrilled about is how this project has been a balance of masculine and feminine energy. I'm so glad I never tried to do this without my partner, Kimberly. And she brought to the whole project not only her skills as a producer and a director and her on-screen presence, but she really coached me to remember to keep conveying this information from a place of my confidence about our ways out, because that is very real in me. And I know that for me and for Alex Jones and David Icke and others who are involved in conveying this information, it's easy for us to get into our warrior spirit and get kind of carried away with intense male anger and indignation about what's being done to us. And there's a place for that, but it's not necessarily optimal when we're first conveying the information to other people. What Kimberly kept saying to me when she was coaching me on the set was, allow people their own emotional space to take this information in, rather than filling that space with your own passion or fear or anger or indignation or whatever. And the first time that I did that on the set, as I was telling the story in a way that she said, yes, that's what I was talking about, I stepped off the set and a lot of the crew members were in tears. And I looked around and realized, you know, something just happened here. And I realized later on, okay, that's what she was talking about. That's honoring other people's emotional space and not trying to get them to feel anything or not feel anything about it, but simply honor their intelligence by giving them the information, sharing my interpretation for what it's worth, but then letting them do their own interpretation and have their own feeling about it.
Well, it was good advice, and it came across really well.
Well, what we're hearing, because we're just inundated with letters and Facebook posts and emails all day long, every day now. It's so heartwarming to see. And so many women especially are writing in and saying, thank you for making this information user-friendly for the first time. I finally feel like I can wrap around it and now go do something about it. And I'll tell you, as a lifelong activist, one of the things I've noticed is that once women take an issue on and say, no, you're not going to do this to my family,
right,
that's the tipping point. It will be handled.
Yeah, I think there's two things that this, the world governments and religions and everything, they haven't taken into account. One is the internet, and the other one is women.
Yes.
I think as women wake up, there's a whole chapter in my book about women waking up, because as they wake up, that's going to be the dismantling of a lot of these patriarch organizations that have hardened and crystallized. But when you start putting feminine energy in, like male energy is like, bam, but feminine energy is a constant push, and you don't notice it until it's transitioned into something else.
Yes.
And that's what we need. We don't need that male punch. We need the feminine, gentle, constant, transitional energy. Because without that, and I feel that coming inside myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel myself becoming less combative, less conflictive, and less argumentative, because there was a part of me that I keep in check that enjoys the argument and the conflict, the debate, and being right. And I always try to pull that back and, like you say, give the other person the space to be, because it's not a matter of right or wrong. It's a matter of finding the truth, wherever that leads us.
Yeah, I'm so thrilled about just the emerging blending that's going on between masculine and feminine as the patriarchy is being exposed, and as masculine and feminine energies are starting to work together in co-creative coupleness. It's like it sounds like you are. One of the great joys of my life is to be able to do that with Kimberly. And inside each one of us, we each have that masculine and feminine aspect, and I think we're each learning to integrate and balance that as well.
Yeah, it's somebody asked me, because my wife and I, we have a really close, good relationship, and they asked me about it, and I said, well, it's a little bit like a 24-hour workshop, you know, because you're constantly in this interplay of creating space, you know, so you can both have your own space, but merging it back together. I know one of the people in some of your side interviews was talking about that. And it's important to be able to respect each other's space, but at the same time, be able to merge. And when you merge, the ego can't be there.
Yeah.
And that's been one of the best part of my awakening and stepping out of myself into the universe, is through my partner, through relationship.
Yes, and it's one of the reasons why we have the image on our poster for the movie that we did. There is a woman of color lifting a blindfold off, and it says the world is waking up. And we were looking for some sort of iconic imagery that would symbolize the world waking up, but especially because of the dominance of the patriarchy, really for centuries, and of people of color as well. We wanted to symbolize as clearly as we could that era is ending, that we're moving into the era where everyone of every race, every gender, every age can be empowered. Now, some people misunderstood that and wanted to attack the trailer saying, oh, it looks like an Illuminati symbolism. And we had never thought of that. I would, you know, I could say, oh, yeah, I see that there is a triangle and it's one eye. Oh, my God, if I thought of that, I wouldn't have done it. There was no intention to do that at all. But on the other hand, even if I knew it, I still love that image of the women representing all of us waking up.
Yeah, there's a lot of little things in your documentary that I've noticed. Even the clock in the background of one of your scenes is 10 minutes after 11, you know?
That one was intentional because we were pointing to 11-11, which is when we were going to debut the film. But there is no particular esoteric and definitely not Illuminati meaning going on with that 11-11. The true story about 11-11 for our film was that we asked all of our teams, what is the earliest that we could premiere this film that we could count on your team's work being done? We put all that together and it came out to November 18th, 2011. So we said, okay, we'll set the launch for then. And then we went to put it on the calendar and realized that's too close to Thanksgiving. And we want people to be able to come to the premiere and experience the launch. So let's see if we can move it back a week because we wanted to do it on a Friday night. So we looked at the calendar and my wife and I looked at each other and it's like, oh my gosh, it's 11-11. So we thought, well, it's a catchy date. People will remember it. We're all for oneness, particularly when it's one standing next to a one, standing next to a one rather than any one dominating the rest. So I thought, okay, maybe we're being guided to do this date. But that's truly all there was to it.
Well, it seems like it's working out well, Foster.
I think so. We have felt that this project has been so guided, that we do everything we can with hard work and our rational mind and logic, but then ultimately we just keep surrendering again and again to just the right person showing up at the right time and it happening on the right date. And this is, again, where the intellect and the intuition, the masculine and the feminine, are learning how to blend with each other, and I agree with you that there's no good reason that we've seen not to keep honoring that in our process.
Is there anything you'd like to say in closing?
Well, I'd like to, first of all, thank anyone who sees this, who's had the courage to watch this film, to immerse themselves in the website, and then especially to share it with your loved ones. I know wholeheartedly that it takes courage to share this information with friends. I thank you for doing that, since so many are, and can share with you that all over the world, people are being thrilled by the response that they're getting. Like, people did screenings for their family over Thanksgiving. People are buying stocking stuffers for their aunts and uncles for Christmas. So I can say that you will be most likely rewarded, at least in the long run, if not in the short run, for sharing this. And I guess finally I would say that the bottom line for me is we do all have what it takes to thrive, as we say in the final line of our theme song, which ends the movie. And we're doing what we call Thrive Movement as our offering, joining with all of the other movements. And it's a self-creating movement that you're welcome to participate in any way that you want. But finally, I just honor what is waking up in each one of you. And I'm confident that as that's happening, we have what it takes to turn this thing around. And I thank you in advance for everything that you're doing to make that happen.
As we thank you too, Foster. Really appreciate it.
It's been an honor to have this conversation with you. Thanks a lot.
All right.